Hi, this is Steve Fuller, and I'm a professor of sociology at the University of Warwick. And what I'm known for is a field called social epistemology, which I founded about 25 years ago. And this field is concerned with the social foundations of knowledge. And by social foundations, I mean a broad range of things, namely how knowledge is organized, to what purpose knowledge is organized, in other words, why do we want knowledge, what is knowledge good for, and how should this be organized not only in terms of the past, in terms of how other cultures, other societies have done it, but also in terms of where we should be, or how should we be organizing our knowledge in the future. So it has a kind of policy perspective, you might say, on this. And of course, one of the most important issues about the organization of knowledge, and indeed the purpose, the reason why we want to organize knowledge in a certain way, has a lot to do with the nature of what it is to be a human being. And so we have these fields that you've been studying in the university known as the humanities. And the humanities, quite explicitly, are fields that are designed to, as it were, turn us into human beings in the proper sense, in some sort of normatively acceptable sense, right? The way human beings ought to think, the way they ought to behave. And one can understand this idea as either being quite a broad notion, namely that they're, you know, that human beings need to be able to be open-minded and tolerate a lot of difference and diversity and so forth, or it could actually mean that there are certain sorts of values that are intrinsically human values that need to be upheld under every circumstance. So something like, let's say, the sanctity of life. And all of these notions about what it means to be a human being has been very much important in terms of how one organizes the humanities curriculum. That is to say, in terms of what books you read. So, for example, do you read the Bible or the Quran or one of these classic religious books? Do you read novels, for example, or poetry or history or philosophy? All of these different fields, or for that matter, the arts, right? Music, painting, all of these different fields actually are said to, in some way or another, at least arguments have been made, that they actually contribute to what it means to be a human being. Now, we happen to be entering into a period in history where this kind of a notion can no longer really be taken for granted. And what I mean by that is not only that people have an enormous amount of disagreement over what should be in the humanities. So, for example, if you have not already noticed, right, the humanities tend to be very much biased toward Western authors, and indeed male white Western authors. And typically these are authors that in one way or another were very much part of the establishment, or at least were very well educated people themselves. And in this respect, it represents a kind of very elite cut of all of the members of Homo sapiens who've in fact qualify, in principle at least, for being human. So in other words, the sort of sample, right, of the human experience that you actually get from the humanities, historically speaking, has been rather restricted, even though within that limited domain, of course, you are exposed to an enormously wide range of thoughts and experiences and feelings and all the rest of it. And sometimes this can even be the case if you're just reading one author, like Shakespeare, for example, or Plato. But this is all being challenged now. And it's not just being challenged, though, because of these people who wrote the books were all white Western males. There's also a kind of more fundamental problem that's on the horizon, and this is represented by these other two terms that I have up here for you to look at, post-human and transhuman, and corresponding to these is the post-humanities and the transhumanities. Just to give you a kind of a simplified view of what the difference is, What one I think the easiest way to think about the post-human is to basically think that this idea that that the humanities take for granted, that somehow there is a kind of fundamental value to human experience. That is to say, being a human being has a kind of special value of its own, and so it becomes important to understand that and to know what that means. And that's why you read all these great books and you experience all this great art and all the rest of it. That this is called into question. Why? Because perhaps the human itself is not the primary locus of value in the world. That in fact, there are more fundamental values than being human. For example, being alive might be one of them. And the difference between being alive and being human is actually quite an important one with regard to the post-humanities, because part of what the post-human condition will draw our attention to is this idea that, look, we are not the only species inhabiting the universe. We may think that we're the most important beings around, but that might just be a kind of species chauvinism or even narcissism. In fact, we inhabit a universe that's populated by plants, animals, and all sorts of other creatures, many of whom we have not yet discovered and may exist in other planets, and who knows. So in any case, what one has to think about in terms of where the value of reality comes from is not to focus or fetishize so much the human, but to think in a kind of broader canvas. And so the post-humanities very often are associated with things like environmental concerns. Okay? When one thinks about something like global warming, for example, and the way in which life on this planet is potentially jeopardized, not only human life, but even more directly the life of many species, many of whom have already gone extinct as a result of the human footprint on the planet, you begin to realize that maybe being human or acting as humans characteristically do is not necessarily an unmitigated good, right? That we may be doing a lot of harm by virtue of stressing the difference between being human and, let's say, being a living being, okay? And so the post-humanities will draw attention to this fact. And so if you were to design a curriculum in the post-humanities, you would probably want to emphasize forms of literature and forms of experience that in fact show the relationship and even the dependency of human beings on other creatures, right? That we are in some sense part of a larger ecological web, a great chain of being, perhaps, to use a kind of old theological expression. That maybe we are just one among many creatures, all of whom have value by virtue of all inhabiting the same reality. And of course, a lot of, if you think about this from a religious standpoint, I think, those of you who are familiar with the great Eastern religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, and also Taoism in China, I mean, all of these religions have a very strong post-human dimension to it. In the sense that even when the human being is being discussed, the human being is really not a privileged form, but simply a kind of temporary form, you might say, a kind of form that coexists with other forms for certain periods of time, for certain purposes, etc. In contrast, if you think about the humanities and the privileging of the human being, okay, the kinds of religions that we're often talking about here are the so-called Abrahamic religions, right? And so what I mean here is Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Now, what all these religions have in common, even though they have been in conflict with each other in a way for thousands of years, nevertheless, one of the things that they all share is a privileging of the human being as more or less created in the image and likeness of God. I mean, Islam's a bit different in this regard. It doesn't quite privilege the human the way in which Judaism and Christianity does. But nevertheless, even within Islam, the human being has a very special kind of standing, and this is why when God delivers the message in the Quran, it is to a human being in a human vessel, and it's done through the distinctly human medium of language. Okay? When we talk about the humanities, and the privileging of the human being, from a religious standpoint, the Abrahamic religions are very much in the background, you might say, of this kind of thinking. And indeed, I think it's worth saying that even though in the modern period, so we think about the period starting with the Enlightenment in the 18th century, where gradually you start to get the removal of church authority over the political arena, over the intellectual arena. We start to think about the way in which science pulls away from religion, the way in which schools become independent of the church, all of these kinds of things that go on primarily in the 18th and 19th centuries. Nevertheless, one of the things that remains constant through this period is, in fact, the privileging of the human beings, okay? So, in other words, even though, you formally have governments and scientists and all sorts of people saying that they no longer believe in the church and that, they're no longer going to be reading the Bible or anything like that, nevertheless, the fundamental metaphysical assumption of the centrality of human beings to the cosmos remains the same, okay? And I think it's fair to say that that remains the default position within higher education in terms of how the curriculum is organized, especially when we talk about the humanities, because after all, the humanities still is focused on distinctive human contributions and as a way of coming to a self-understanding of who we are. I mean, because after all, if you were a post-humanist, right, one of the things that you might think is, well, look, if we're training people for a future where you want people to be able to live more comfortably, more associatively, right, more knowledgeably with other non-human creatures, then what sort of an education would you provide for them? Wouldn't you want them to learn more about biology? Wouldn't you want them to learn, to become, observers of nature and to be sensitive to their environments more? All right? I mean, if you think about the kinds of skills, for example, that get cultivated in the humanities, so going beyond what's written in the curriculum, right? If you start to think about what skills you learn how to write. Back in the old days, at least when I was in school, you learned how to speak. I realize people don't really learn how to speak anymore, but you used to do that too. And again, all of these skills were typically skills that were definitive of what it was to be a human being. In other words, it was something that animals didn't do. And that was deliberate, right? Those were the skills, the distinguishing skills of the human being. So think about it. Right? When we talk about people who are uneducated, it was quite common, even into the modern era, to compare people who cannot write and speak very well as animals, right? And that people would be made fun of for sounding like animals because they don't have the sophisticated, nuanced modes of expression that human beings get by virtue of learning how to read and write and speak properly. That's very humanistic, right? That is all about refining a creature who is distinguishing itself as much as possible from animals. Well, see, the post-humanity said we have gone too far in this direction, and what we need to do is to actually develop kind of forms of understanding that are not so biased toward things that only human beings can do. And so, when people talk about the ability of becoming one with nature, being able to have kind of a sympathetic understanding with animals or even with plants, right? Getting into that kind of mindset where you're able to relate to your environment in a way where you feel a kind of community, and this is kind of one of the notions of ecology that get promoted, right? This too requires certain kinds of skills. I mean, see, in this respect, whatever you might think about Charles Darwin's views about human beings, You know, if you read a book like Origin of the Species, or in fact any of Darwin's larger, later works, you really do get a good sense in reading him about a person who is a very close observer of nature and has a kind of feeling for it, right? Gets a sense of what's going on, what's making things happen, and trying to come up with a comprehensive understanding of that. Now, you see, that's the post-humanities would be stressing that kind of thing. Okay, so I think you get the idea about, you know, how the post-humanities would in fact take us quite a ways beyond the sort of centrality of the human that's been characteristic of the humanities. And indeed, you know, it would kind of put us in a place that would be very close, I think, to certain green sensibilities, as well as certain of the Eastern religious sensibilities, I think. But now, I want to turn to what is the official topic, and is the topic that has been most concern to me in the last few years, and that's the transhuman, transhumanities. Now, in a sense, the transhuman moves in the diametrically opposed direction from the posthuman. Okay? So if the posthuman is understood to be about decentering the human condition, in other words, the human is no longer the primary locus of value, if that's the posthuman, then the transhuman basically believes that, in a sense, humanism hasn't gone far enough. In other words, the transhumanist wants to amplify the difference between the human and the non-human even more than it already is. Okay? Now, this is why, when we talk about transhumanists, one of the things that is immediately on the horizon is the role of technology. Okay, especially technology understood as an extension of the human condition. So we can talk about technology in terms of being the extension of our senses. This is a kind of notion that the great media theorist, Canadian media theorist Marshall McLuhan, was promoting in the 1960s. We have things like telephone and television and radio and all of these different media, right, amplify our senses, enable us to hear and to see things that go far beyond what our natural modes of perception would enable us to do. Okay, so obviously there's that sense of the kind of technological extension of the senses. But there's also, and this is of more concern perhaps to transhumanists, there's the technological extension of our cognitive capacities in a higher order sense. So in other words, that we can think more comprehensively and more quickly and more efficiently and more accurately, and we can draw on a larger memory base, and we can make many different calculations simultaneously to come up with answers. In other words, a kind of a computational vision of the mind, right, becoming preeminent. And of course, with the computer revolution that took place in the beginning and in the Cold War, but of course with the end of the Cold War, this revolution has been kind of, mainstreamed, so that now computers are basically, you know, impossible to escape, and they're insinuated into all aspects of our lives, and are actually enhancing our lives in quite direct, profound ways, to such an extent that, you know, if you lose your smartphone, you might as well have lost a lobe in your brain. So the transhumanists are very sensitive to this point, right? Because what all of this technology has ended up doing is it has actually enabled human beings to do things and think about things and conceptualize things. I mean, think about virtual reality and all the things that are made possible that way. Things that really take us far away from our default position as biological animals. And that's the key point. Because the transhumanist actually has a kind of radical view with regard to our animal nature. Because one of the things that I would say is shared between the humanist and the posthumanist is a basic understanding that at the end of the day, a human being is a member of Homo sapiens. In other words, we are an upright ape. And we may be an upright ape with kind of lots of enhancements, in the sense that our, you know, forebrain is developed, you know, largely through things like writing and developing tools that then take on a life of their own, and, you know, the whole history of science and technology is implicated here. But nevertheless, you know, for all of these achievements and the, you know, the feats of civilization that the human beings have done over the last, whatever, 4,000 or 6,000 years, nevertheless, this has all been done by an upright ape, okay? And when we talk about complex social organization, and we talk about, you know, the interconnectivity of the World Wide Web and our ability to access things and access each other, at the end of the day, the ultimate nodes are upright apes. At least this is something that humanists and posthumanists would be pretty much agreed on. And so, in a sense, one assumption then that they share is that we're on Earth. And Earth is where we're going to be. And Earth is to be understood in its usual biogeological sense, okay? In other words, we shouldn't expect that human beings will be inhabiting the entire cosmos. We may wish to know about the cosmos. We may make some occasional visits there. We may even have a space station there. But at the end of the day, we are Earth-bound creatures. This is something that is shared by humanists and posthumanists. Okay? Transhumanists, on the other hand, have a much more open-minded view of the matter. Okay? And so what that means is that you it's not like they deny, I mean, it's not like they deny that we are biological creatures, but I think they regard our biology as basically a platform, to use contemporary parlance. In other words, the human body is basically a site, a place, where lots of different capacities can be developed and deployed. Now, why is the human body the place for this? Well, this is what, you know, if you believe Darwin's theory of evolution, for example, you say, well, you know, over the course of billions of years, you know, the molecules came together, and then DNA got formed, and then we went through the tree of life and all the rest of it, and it just so happens that this kind of carbon-based creature, right, that looks a bit like an ape, turned out to be the platform on which then all of these marvelous capacities, okay, that the humanists first drew our attention to, came about. But from the transhumanist standpoint, this observation is nothing more than a historical accident. In other words, it may well be true that we became the beings we are by virtue of biological evolution, but it does not follow that we need to stay in that form, okay? And this is where the transhumanists start to get, you might say, incredibly open-minded about what the future of humanity is. Now, there are some transhumanists who actually, in a way, are perfectly happy with the human body as the platform on which to develop our intelligence and our senses and all the rest of it. And these guys typically think that what we should be doing is thinking in terms of getting rid of death. Okay? Now this is quite an interesting proposition from the standpoint of the humanities. Because if you've ever studied any of the more philosophical stuff about the humanities, this is true both on the religious side and on the non-religious side, one of the things that you will find people in philosophy and literature and history always pondering about the human condition is the fact that we ultimately die. Okay? Kierkegaard and Heidegger and all these people who we call existentialists talked about as being unto death, right? That there's some sense in which, you know, to be a human being is to know that you're going to die someday, you know? And this focuses the mind. And a lot of the way in which we organize the human condition actually has to do with the fact that we know we're going to die. And this, you know, so the life cycle, to put it in more general terms, right? The way social life is organized, right? The idea that you're born at a certain time, you develop, right? You hold jobs, you retire, and you die. And this happens in a fairly predictable fashion. Of course, the numbers of years that it's taken has gotten extended, of course, over the last few thousand years. But nevertheless, there is a point of death. Now, transhumanists basically want to get rid of that. And the interesting thing is they believe that even if they got rid of it, that you'd still, in a way, have everything that's good about being human. In other words, the death is another kind of historical accident about the human condition. Just like we were born as ape-like creatures, the fact that we were born with kind of death programmed into us through the deterioration of our genes, that's also a historical accident. In other words, in principle, we could transcend, right? This is where the trans part of transhuman comes in, right? We can transcend these kinds of liabilities that we're born with. And so, a lot of transhumanism is very much about thinking about what it would mean to extend life indefinitely, and you know, and how would you live, and where would you live, and there's a lot of very interesting kinds of issues that are surrounding there, and I don't want to get into all of those now. We might have an opportunity to talk about them when I'm there in person. But that's a form of transhumanism that keeps us inside the human body, biologically understood. That's the point I want to make here. But the other type of transhumanism goes in a completely different direction, and it basically says that we will at some point abandon the human body to go for some more durable silicon form. Okay, and so the idea here is that you have to think about what are those marvelous distinguishing characteristics of human beings that we want to continue indefinitely in a more durable medium. Right, so you might think about all of this kind of reasoning capacity and memory storage and the ability to project all kinds of possibilities and to kind of go through them in an infinite virtual reality space. Right, this might be kind of what we're talking about here. And indeed, as our lives get more and more integrated with information technology, right, there is a sense in which a kind of merging of the human and the technological conditions is happening de facto. And so people talk about, sometimes in very apocalyptic ways, they talk about the singularity, okay? And the singularity, we could talk about that if you want to, is basically this moment in the future. Sometimes people think it's going to happen within the next half century, if not sooner. That in a sense we will reach this point where we'll be able to upload our consciousness and we'll be able to sort of extend indefinitely throughout the cosmos in some durable silicon form. Okay? I mean, people haven't quite worked out the details to everyone's satisfaction, so don't worry. Nevertheless, this is a kind of image of transhumanity that is very much alive, very vivid, and in fact we do have intermediate stages of this idea. So it's you know, you shouldn't just think in terms of, okay, today we are these upright apes, okay, and then tomorrow we're suddenly going to be the voice in the machine. No, there's actually intermediate stages, and you may know about these already, and cyborgs, which are these entities that are, you know, partly, sometimes mostly human, but nevertheless with very significant technological infrastructure to them, right? That very significantly enhance the being. You know, so if you've watched the later episodes of Star Trek, you know, in most of the science fiction movies, there's usually one or two characters, right, who have these special kind of powers, who are effectively cyborgs. And of course, as our prosthetic devices get more and more sophisticated, that is to say, the kinds of artificial limbs, other kind of artificial, even artificial organs, artificial enhancements to the brain, right? All of these things, as they become more sophisticated, we can actually talk about people becoming cyborgs or living a cyborg existence, all right? And indeed, there are some people, for example, who would be quite happy to say that a guy like Stephen Hawking, who's a quadriplegic, and basically has to do everything through a kind of thought-controlled computer, right, that moves his wheelchair and types stuff for him and moves his, you know, the voice recorder, that he's a cyborg already, okay? So this is the other kind of transhuman future we're talking about. Basically, one in which the human evacuates the biological body altogether. Now, you see, the thing that's interesting about transhumanism, and this is the thing that, you know, we would need to talk about, you know, when I get there, is has transhumanism thrown the baby out with the bathwater with regard to the human? Okay? Because remember, the transhumanist, unlike the posthumanist, wants, in a sense, to take the things that are really distinctive about human beings, that separate us out the most from the animals, and amplify that indefinitely. Okay? That's the idea, basically. However, in the course of doing that, the sorts of things that they end up losing, so losing mortality, for example, even losing the biological character of Homo sapiens, losing those things may in fact be losing too much, and that in some sense, the transhumanists end up creating some kind of weird monstrosity, perhaps. It's not clear. It's certainly up in the air. Transhumanists don't see it that way, though, of course. They actually see themselves as the natural heirs to the human. Okay? In other words, they see themselves as really humanity 2.0. So this gets us to kind of where I would like us to start talking about things when I get to the classroom on Friday. You know, I think one general question you might want to have in the back of your mind is, it's pretty clear, it seems to me at least, that the vision of the human, the post-human, and the transhuman, the differences between these visions are actually quite profound. But the other thing about it is that they're not likely, the differences aren't likely to be resolved very soon. They're likely to kind of continue to exist in parallel streams, okay? And so then the question becomes, and this is a question to think about, is can we actually live in a society that tolerates these three radically different visions of the human condition and how it relates to the rest of reality, okay? And so with that, I will stop here, and I look forward to seeing you on Friday.